Hello and welcome to episode 120 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Toedy, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, many other postings. How are you this morning, Bill?
I'm freezing down here in Florida. It's a middle of the winter, 60 degrees. I can't believe how cold it is.
Well, and yeah, John.
Yeah, John Minneapolis. I know he's not going to want to hear that.
So if you are listening and or watching, you've heard another voice on here this week. Bill and I have our return special guest with us. He's been here before. We always love to have him. He's the one, the only, my good buddy, John Parshall. John, how are you?
I am very well and shedding a single tear for Bill in Florida.
Yeah. Exactly.
Hey, keep shedding them because it's 80 degrees here in Hattiesburg today. 80.
I like it cold. All right.
Well, I do too. So tomorrow night
short
is going to
sleeve shirt. I don't care.
Yeah, tomorrow it's going to drop 50 degrees overnight. So yeah.
Good.
Anyway. Okay. So back to the important topic. If you've been listening to the podcast as of late, you are well aware that we are making our way through the slugfest that is the Guadalcanal campaign. While the fighting ashore has raged on and off between pitched engagements, the seas around the canal have been anything but quiet. Savo Island in August was a debacle for the U.S. Navy, to put it mildly. The carrier forces under Admiral Fletcher landed some fairly significant blows on the Japanese carrier force at Eastern Solomons, and Admiral Norman Scott finally exacted some revenge for Savo at the Battle of Cape Esperance. The U.S. Navy has had its share of victories, as well as defeats in these bloody waters. And while the fighting has been significant at sea, it's not over, not by a long shot. The calendar now sits in October 1942, October 26th, to be exact. And ashore, the Japanese have launched a massive offensive to push the Marines and Army now off of Guadalcanal. The October offensive and the fighting that takes place ashore will be remembered as the Battle for Henderson Field. The fighting at sea that takes place only a day later, all coinciding with the offensive ashore, will be called the Battle of Santa Cruz. So, gentlemen, this is a battle that, you know, any carrier battle in 1942 ultimately gets overshadowed by the Battle of Midway and then the Battle of Coral Sea. This, I would venture to argue, is just as important, certainly more important than Coral Sea, and it's right maybe just a frog's hair below Midway in terms of importance. And this is a big battle. This is a large battle. John, the Japanese send a large fleet down here.
Yeah.
A lot. They send a lot of boats down here.
Yeah. No, they're basically scraping up everything they've got in their carrier inventory at this point and sending it south. So we've got the veterans of Cardiff 5, which is Shokaku and Zuikaku, and we have two newly converted carriers, the Junyo and the Hiyo, which were converted ocean liners, actually. And so they don't have the kind of top-end speed that you associate with a fleet carrier, but they're relatively large and carry a decent number of aircraft. And then they've also got a light fleet carrier, the Zuiho. So, yeah, they're bringing a lot of flight techs to this party.
And they're bringing, as they typically do, a lot of surface forces too. So they're bringing some battle wagons down here, some heavy cruisers, some light cruisers, a flock of destroyers.
I mean, this 24, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I believe so. Yeah, 24. Well, yeah, I think it was actually more than that, but 24, I think, is the generally accepted number. Yeah, mm-hmm. And so they're not just doing this willy nilly. They have a plan. What is the plan here, John? The Japanese plan for this offensive, because that's what this is all coinciding with the land, but what are their plans?
Right, and that's kind of what makes it interesting, is that you've got one of the rare instances where there's actually cooperation between the Imperial Army and the Imperial Navy. That what's going to happen here is that the Army is has brought in a complete division, the 2nd Division, the Sendai Division, and has hacked a road through the jungle, and they're going to launch this attack against Henderson Field. They're going to capture Henderson, put it out of business, and at that point, the Imperial Navy can move south, take care of any, you know, opposition that is in its way, and then from that point on, the Japanese are now going to be able to bring in supplies using actual transport ships instead of destroyers, and mop up the American enclave that is still on board the island. So it's a coordinated land-sea offensive.
Yeah, combined arms, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's important to note that, you know, when we aired our episode on Henderson Field, which will actually air next week before this one, it's important to note that everything is interconnected. You know, the Navy is waiting on the Army to do their job. The right. Army is depending on the Navy to come in and do their job once the Army does their job. So it's all, you know, contingent on a lot of different aspects here.
Yeah, the Navy does not want to get within air range of Henderson Field, obviously, until Henderson has been captured.
And that's a huge part. That's a very important point, is that the Japanese not necessarily were going to support the offensive on land. It's not like they weren't necessarily going to send in air support and things like that, right, to aid the infantry attacks. They were going to come in after they'd captured Henderson, so they were not under the threat of being attacked from the unstoppable carrier.
Yeah, correct. But that means that in the early parts of this battle, the Navy is kind of loitering to the north, waiting to initiate their activities until they know that the Army has done their thing. And as the Army is discovering, it's a lot harder than we planned to get our attack units into position because of the density of the jungle. And so that ends up delaying the Army's attack by a day at least.
Well, the density of the jungle also had an impact on the Japanese carrier's ability to provide close air support to those ground troops as they're attacking.
And they had no doctrine to do that kind of stuff in any case. And so if you are interested in close air support, you got to look elsewhere than the Japanese military because they really didn't know how to do it.
They didn't do that. Okay.
And even in regards to that, we really were still learning how to do that in the Pacific too. I mean, you know, the planes from Henderson Field were supporting marine defensive operations and defensive operations on Guadalcanal, but not to the extent that they do at like Tarawa,
right,
places like that. Before that doctrine was still being written.
Yeah, if you know, the people you look to that are good at doing that kind of stuff at this point in the war are the Germans, obviously, and also, interestingly, Western Desert Air Force in Egypt and Libya. They're really good at it, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Krauts did.
They knew how to do that.
They did indeed. So the pre-sailing plans, you know, for the Japanese, for the Navy, we're talking about the Navy here, pre-sailing plans for the Japanese, they had their typical dispersion of forces, right? I mean, they got what, three, I think, support force was everything, but the vanguard force, the main force, and there was another one I can't remember right now.
Yeah, for our purposes, you know, we've got two separate carrier forces here, so they've split their two carrier divisions in half. Again, this is a lesson that's been learned at Midway, is that we don't want to put all of our eggs in one basket. And then the vanguard force, which is composed mostly of fast battleships and cruisers, is out in front of these two carrier formations, both as a scouting asset to be able to put up float planes to search for the enemy, and also, frankly, to act as a bit of an air power sump to soak up American air attacks. Maybe they'll go after a nice, juicy battleship instead of going after one of our carriers.
Did they overcomplicate this battle plan the way the Japanese tended to do in every other
battle? They always do that, right? I mean, that's the thing we love about the Japanese Navy in this war, is overcomplicated battle plans. I think that the notion of a vanguard force is sort of questionable. Really, when I look at that, I see a weakness in Japan's overall anti-aircraft doctrine for its warships. Those assets would have been better used in close-in defense of the Japanese carriers themselves, but they didn't have very good anti-aircraft weaponry, and their doctrine was, when you're under air attack, Mr. Carrier, the thing you want to do is maneuver wildly and use evasive maneuvers to avoid the incoming ordnance. Makes it very difficult for supporting warships to keep station on a wildly maneuvering aircraft carrier. And the thing is, if you're maneuvering a lot, you're throwing your own fire control solutions out the window. So, that's kind of what's going on there.
But as we will see in the battle that develops, the Americans looked at that the opposite way.
Completely different way. Yep.
And it works.
Yeah.
So one thing that we have not, or I don't recall us talking about on this podcast at all, or if we did, it was very few and far between, is Japanese intelligence. Japanese intel for this battle is this is one of those events, one of those times where their intelligence plays a pretty big part in what they're going to do and how they're going to understand things as they develop. Right, John?
Yeah, and this is one of the few instances they've got at least a fairly good idea of the assets that we have in the neighborhood. And some of that, as you mentioned in your notes to this battle, is a self-inflicted wound, and that we're talking on our media about the fact that, yeah, we've got a carrier down close to Guadalcanal at this point in time. Mm-hmm. They know that Yorktown has been sunk by this point. Of course, they know the Lexington has been sunk. And so, you know, they can read the newspapers reasonably well. They know what was on the building ways. And so it seems reasonable to them that there's one carrier down here and there may be a second.
Now, this wasn't the congressman spilling the beans, as happened with the depth charges,
no,
right?
No, it was just, Seth, you actually know this better than I do, that there was like a newsreel.
Yeah,
footage.
Israel footage.
That's exactly right.
For a sea clash or something like that.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it was like I think it was Movie Tone News, which is was a big company.
Yeah,
and it spit this out across theaters in the nation. That's
every movie preceded with Movie Tone News.
Yeah,
anytime anybody went to a theater, that's the first thing you saw.
Yeah, and it said, I mean, I don't remember exactly word for word, but it did say that at this time U.S. Naval Air Forces are preparing for a sea clash off the coast of Guadalcanal. It's like, really?
Yeah. Where were the sensors, huh?
Yeah. Oops.
Yeah. And I mean, it's and they were referring to, of course, Hornet. And what's the reason the Japanese weren't able to pinpoint the location of Hornet, but they had a pretty good idea where she was. And they figured it was Hornet mainly because they knew they'd hit Enterprise, and Enterprise was more than likely out of Pearl Harbor, which she was. But there was a lot of traffic analysis. And we talked about in one episode about Station Hypo that's how we, at least in the beginning of the war, you know, got a lot of our intel, was not just necessarily by reading mail, but by
radio direction finding, trying to figure out, okay, this is a message, we think it comes from this kind of ship, and gain a lot of intelligence. Meanwhile, the Japanese think they're going to go see a John Wayne movie, and they're getting intel delivered to them. So they started watching more John Wayne movies, I guess.
Yeah,
no, exactly. But I mean, that's exactly what they're doing here, is they're analyzing the traffic patterns, because they notice that there's a lot of information going from Pearl Harbor to what they deem to be a powerful naval unit off the coast of Guadalcanal that is, mysteriously not answering.
Or a collection of naval units.
Yeah. Right.
So it tips them off that something's out there. Something out there is pretty big. So, again, based on traffic patterns, I also figure that Enterprise, and they actually do say that it is Enterprise, is in Pearl Harbor and going to be on its way to the area. I think, what did the date? On or about October 15th.
Mm-hmm.
Which is within 24 hours of Enterprise sailing. So, I mean, they were.
Yeah.
So then could they deduce that the Hornet was this powerful naval presence down near Guadalcanal at this point?
That I'm about 99% sure that they do figure that it is USS
Hornet. Process of elimination, right?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
They knew Saratoga was hit. You know, so, I mean,
she so often was.
Yeah, I know. Magnet for torpedoes.
Yeah, really.
But, so we talked about it in the beginning here. The land influences the sea, and it does. So what happens on land directly influences really the way things shake out for this particular battle in terms of aircraft carriers available for the fight. And I'm talking about the United States and the Japanese here at the same time. John, you mentioned they had, they had five carriers, they had five flight decks. They had Shikoku, Zuikaku, the light carrier, Zuiho, yep. Thank you. And then Junyo and Hiyo. Well, something happens to one of the new carriers, doesn't it?
Yeah, Hiyo has a problem in her engineering spaces, has a fire. And the propulsion plants of these two carriers were notoriously cranky. And so I guess it's not, that odd that there would have been a fire. But the bottom line is that, she gets sort of involuntarily put out of action and has to peel off before the battle actually joins. And so I forget what that brings the actual aircraft count down. I've got my notes over here, but it does subtract, about 50 aircraft from the overall Japanese roster.
It takes away a flight deck, which is important, you know, in any way, shape, or form. And not to say that the fire wouldn't happen. The fire happens. But the Japanese force was delayed because of the army being delayed on Guadalcanal.
Yep.
So had they been on time, Hayo may have very well been in that area to do battle at that time or
before.
But still, they've got what? They still have what, 4 decks? Door one in the South Pacific? 3.5. Door one in the South Pacific? I mean, it's still odds way in their favor, right?
Yeah.
It is. And the Imperial Japanese Army is delayed again. Again, if you've listened to the Henderson Field Battle episode, you know they're delayed 2 or 3 times. Yeah. They are delayed from initiating their offensive until the 24th.
Yep.
And while this is, you know, fine and dandy, the big takeaway here is that because they're delayed until the 24th, the United States gets another flight deck in the form of USS Enterprise, because she's hauling ass from Pearl Harbor to meet up, and she does make it in time. If the Japanese had been able to launch their offensive from the sea when they wanted to, the Big E would not have been there.
Well, you have to wonder if Halsey would have, you know, authorized a fight with just a single flight deck.
Mm-hmm.
So
against the intelligence that he had, I believe the intel that he was reading is that there were 3 flight decks, Japanese flight decks.
I think that's right. Yeah. Which is wrong.
right. For sure. But I mean, 3 against 1.
Mm-mm. No, that was not.
But still, we're talking about Halsey here, right? The guy who missed Midway, and would he have decided this is my opportunity to catch up reputation wise?
And the other motivation for Halsey, of course, is that as soon as he takes, as soon as he took over command of that theater, one of the things he had done was, you know, go to Guadalcanal and actually spent some time with the Marines and, you know, ask Vandegrift, you know, can you hold here? And Vandegrift is like, yeah, I can, but I need more support from the Navy. And as, you know, my friend Rich Frank frequently relates, you know, if you had thrown a spear through Halsey's heart, you probably could not have wounded him more than those words coming from Vandegrift, you know, because they are implicitly, not even implicitly, the Navy is not holding up its end of the load here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Halsey is powerfully motivated to initiate a fight. But even with that motivation, man, 1 deck against 3, I don't want to take those odds.
No, I don't think so either. And we'll talk about Hornet and her makeup here in just a couple seconds. But even with that, I don't think, as aggressive as he was, I don't think he would have committed that force to battle unless Enterprise is there specifically, Enterprise too.
It would not have passed the calculated risk protocol that Nimitz had called into play. No, certainly
not at all. So the U.S. forces for the battle, they're under a command of a guy that we have not talked about yet. Or at least only in passing. Task Force 16, which of course is centered around the Big E, is under the command of Thomas Kincaid. Kincaid is a relatively, he's not a newcomer, but he's a newcomer to this arena. He's kind of an odd choice, even though, because at that time, there were other people that theoretically could have led this force. What do you think about that, John?
I don't have any intelligent comments one way or the other on that. I'm just going to bat that right back to you. You know,
thanks.
Japanese Navy guy. You like that?
It's good. But I mean, in all seriousness, it was Kincaid was kind of an odd choice. And I mean, you could sit there and say, well, he was the only choice. No, he wasn't, because Frank Jack Fletcher was still around, you know.
Still around, right.
Still around.
Whether King might have said, no, that's the end for him by this point or not, it's another.
We're going to be talking about that later, but
so you're looking at right now, you know, we talked about the Japanese forces. The American forces are split into two task forces as well, 16 and 17. 16's under Kincaid. It's centered around the Enterprise. It's got 1 heavy cruiser, 1 light cruiser, 8 destroyers, and this goes back to what we're talking about, anti-aircraft, 1 battle wagon, and that's USS South Dakota, BB-57, SODAC, as they call her.
Yep.
Task Force 17 is under Admiral George Murray. And he's like, who the hell is George Murray? George Murray was at one time captain of Enterprise at the beginning of the war. So Murray's, he's been around. He's been around carrier operations in the Pacific War. He just recently achieved flag rank. So he's in command of the Hornet Task Force, and they're all falling under Kincaid. And 17, they have, of course, it's Hornet, two light cruisers, two heavy cruisers, and six destroyers. So it's a much smaller task force. They don't have as many guns. This is important here. They do have the USS Juno, which is a anti-aircraft cruiser,
which has just appalling amounts of firepower. But
but they don't have a battleship, and this is important, because we talked about at Eastern Solomons, you know, USS North Carolina's escorting, or she's screening Enterprise, and you know, she lights up her AA for the first time, and it looks like the damn thing's afire, you know?
Yeah.
It's, so this is going to be a big deal here. So previous to Enterprise returning from Pearl Harbor, Hornet was actually the only American aircraft carrier in the Pacific. You know, a lot of people, myself, you know, Enterprise fans say she was the only one. No, it wasn't. Hornet was there for several weeks by herself as well. And Hornet was a veteran carrier, if you will. She was obviously on the Doolittle raid for, you know, everybody knows that. She was at Midway.
She was brand new right before the Doolittle raid as well.
Correct. Right? Yeah. It was first time in the Pacific Ocean was picking up those B-25s. But she's, even though she's seen the elephant, she's still a relatively new carrier.
Yep.
And her air group is also.
Yeah. And her performance at Midway had been terrible.
Appalling. Yeah, it was atrocious. It was atrocious. Yeah. It was absolutely atrocious. Their air group mixture on Hornet is a mixture of newbies and veterans. And even some of the veterans are guys who flew the Flight to Nowhere. You're like, guy we're going to talk about, Clayton Fisher. Clay Fisher in Bombing 8, he was, you know, considered a veteran, but he really only made two attacks in the whole war. So, you know, the mixture is not what it appears to be.
Right.
And you'll see that in their strike performance. I believe anyway. So aside from CV-8, we have my old friend, the USS Enterprise. This is coming into town. Enterprise, this is the first time too. She's equipped with a brand new air group 10. This is the first time that I know of that a brand new air group is outfitted to a veteran carrier and sent to combat in the Pacific War. So air group 10 is similar to Hornet's air group in that it's a mixture of veterans and newbies too. But the veterans that are in this air group are some serious badass dudes. The list of people is it's like a who's who of naval aviation in the Pacific War. VF-10, better known as the Grim Reapers, which, by the way, I'm just going to say, is the baddest squadron nickname of the war. The Grim Reapers, for Christ's sakes, you know.
And that squadron survived the war, by the way. They were around for a long time. VFA 101.
Right.
So they're led by a living legend in Jimmy Flatley. Yeah. Jimmy Flatley was one of the finest naval aviators of his era. He was like Jimmy Thatch. You know, he was a tactician. He was an outstanding pilot and a hell of a leader. The other guys in the squadron's names, guys like Jack Lepla, Coral Sea veteran. Mm-hmm. New guy, Don Gordon, also one of the best nicknames, Flash Gordon. Flash Gordon is he's a new guy, but he'll go all the way through the war, make ace. Whitey Feitner, you know, I mean, these are all people. Whitey Feitner becomes one of the first Blue Angels. So, I mean, these are guys that are, you know, very, very important. And then, of course, the hero of the battle here, at least in my opinion, at least as far as Enterprise is concerned, my old buddy, Sweet Vetiza. So it's just this list of literally it's like who's who of incredible aviators that are going to take part in this.
Right.
You know, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and you kind of see the same thing on the Japanese side, too, that if you look at some of the leaders among their air groups, you've got guys like Murata Shigeharu, the torpedo plane leader. Who was the guy who attacked Battleship Row. He is the finest torpedo plane pilot in the Japanese Navy. You got a guy named Seki, who is one of their best dive bomber pilots. And so what we're really seeing here in this battle, this is kind of the death ride for literally a lot of the remaining Pearl Harbor veterans in the Japanese carrier force. And so this is the last time we are going to see in this war a concentration of really good, experienced Japanese naval aviators.
There's that much talent in the air at one time.
But, yeah. John, you know, we talked before about the both sides treating air battle as actually naval doctrine as a system rather than a collection of individuals. To what extent did individual pilot performance make a difference in this battle as opposed to the systemic application of force?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think if you look, you know, now we're fast forwarding, but look at Seki's attack, you know, that group was, you know, pretty devastating when they came in. So, yes, I am a big picture systemic kind of guy, but at the end of the day, you do have to have aviators that are skilled.
Can hit the target.
Yeah, they got to put ordnance on the target. Mm-hmm. And I'd be the first guy, you know, to flash back to Midway and say, you know, without dudes like, you know, Dick Best, who are capable of nailing that target in a pinch, you got a problem. So, but that, of course, is also the product of a system of pilot training that produces these sorts of individuals. And so,
which we were able to do better than them in the long run, that paid off for us.
For sure. So,
That's, you know, and again, fast forwarding, that's the ultimate, to me, that's the ultimate takeaway from Santa Cruz, is what happens to the Japanese carrier aviators after this battle, during and after this battle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we'll get there. We'll get there. So on the night of October 24, 25, 42, the Japanese send out searchers to find the suspected United States American aircraft carrier in and or around the waters of Guadalcanal. And they do not find Hornet, nor do they find Enterprise, but they do find a guy that we're going to hear about in another two or three episodes by the name of Willis Lee aboard the USS Washington.
Yes.
But they don't attack Lee because they're at extreme range, are they not? I mean, they're
I mean, basically, they just catch a glimpse of this battleship, they're at the end of their tether, and they don't want to do that.
Yeah, but doesn't that force? I might be getting ahead of myself here. The Japanese turn around at one point, but it's after the dang PBYs come in, is it not?
I think that is correct. Yeah.
So
it's when we miss.
And, you know, you see me scratching my head here. I'll tell you what, this is an enormously complex battle. I think that's one of the problems, honestly, from an accessibility standpoint to the average reader. I still have problems getting my head around this particular battle. It does not make the same sort of intuitive sense that something like Midway does. I'm just going to flat out put that out there. So there's a lot of back and forth and, you know,
a lot of moving parts, a lot of complexity, a lot of luck of the draw kind of interactions.
Yep.
Yeah. A lot of pinprick piecemeal attacks too.
Mm-hmm.
That just kind of like throws everything into a pile, and you're looking at it going, "Shit, what is happening here?"
Yeah. How does this make sense?
Yeah. It is and can be very, very confusing. I agree with you 100%. So, around noon on October 25, United States Navy PBYs, I forget the pilot, but he spots two Japanese aircraft carriers late in the day. Halsey, being Admiral Halsey back in Noumea, is reading this mail, and he sends
a very ambiguous, hard to understand message where his guidance isn't very clear. Is that what happens?
That's exactly what happens.
What does he say?
Three words: strike. Repeat, strike.
And you had to repeat it, right? In case you didn't get it the first time, repeat, strike.
Strike, exactly.
Nobody is going to misunderstand that message.
Yeah. No, that is Halsey to a T.
Yep. Yeah.
But so Admiral Kincaid, hearing this, he's like, well, I guess we got a strike. So he does something that it was highly, highly criticized among the aviators on Enterprise at this time, because this is who he launches, is he executes essentially not a deck load, but pretty damn close strike to reach out to get these Japanese and go hit them, knowing full well that more than likely these guys are going to be returning in the dark.
Right.
And you're like, oh, wow, that's a big deal. That is a huge deal in 1942.
Huge deal. Right. Yeah, it's very difficult to recover aircraft, particularly, you know, do you know that all of these aviators are night carrier qualified? Can they
and
actually
they weren't.
Do it? And they weren't, right?
Yeah.
This is a lousy time to learn.
Kincaid is not an aviator, right? And so the aviators are going to blame him for all of this?
They were pissed.
Yeah.
They were pissed. They were hot, but they follow their orders and they do their thing. At this point, this is where the Japanese turn north. The Enterprise strike is gone. They're outbound. The Japanese at this point turn north, and radio silence does not allow. And Kincaid hears this, or he understands as he gets reports that the Japanese have turned, and radio silence does not allow him to recall the strike. And these guys keep on trucking.
Yeah.
It's setting up to be an absolute disaster. So the strike gets out to that location. They're escorted by, I think, six F4Fs from Fightington, one of which is my old buddy Swede. So they get out to that location. There's nothing there.
Nothing.
I mean, jack squat. They're not even looking at porpoises. I mean, there is nothing there. They say, the hell with this. Let's turn back and let's go for home. Well, by this time, it's dark. It's not dusk. It's dark.
And there's no radio RDF beacon on the carrier for them to follow back home.
Well,
right?
Well, there was
they got to get within a certain range.
Certain range.
And that's the key. That's the key. They got to get within a certain range and they have to be at a certain altitude. It's called the YEZB homing device that each SBD and I think all the planes had. And certainly the Enterprise would flip it on and you go to the location.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But you have to be able to receive that transmission in order to find home. So they go back, the strike goes to the reported, you know, where Enterprise is supposed to be to recover them, and she ain't there. And now guys are starting to panic because they're starting to lose fuel, or they're not starting to lose, they're losing fuel. They're starting to get disoriented in the dark. You know, there's a couple of people that are, you know, wingtip to wingtip with people, and they just peel off and they're never seen again. And there's a lot of radio traffic in between the pilots, and guys are starting to freak out, you know, they're starting to panic. And Swede Vet, as it remembers, he said, when we left Pearl Harbor, Enterprise was trailing oil because she'd been hit at Eastern Solomons.
Right.
Enterprise is trailing oil. So he decides, he tells the entire group, comes over the radio and says, follow me. And he literally takes the lead of the entire strike at wave top level. And he's doing S turns because he's looking for that oil.
Wow.
Now, I've heard this story before, but I can never figure out how he sees the oil slick at night.
He turns on his landing lights. Mm-hmm. He turns on his landing lights, and he told me, he says, as I was about to say,
we're done.
We're done. He sees that rainbow, you know how oil does on the water.
Yep.
And he says it's very, very wide. Yeah. He says it's very wide and it starts to get narrower. And he says, as that trail started to get narrower, I knew I'd found home.
Right.
And sure enough, about 15 minutes later, boom, there's Enterprise. So he literally, and there's no doubt here, he literally saves the entire strike. Well, I'd say the entire, the vast majority of Enterprise's strike. And they do land at night. And I believe there's one or two crack ups on the deck, but nobody gets killed that lands on Enterprise.
Right. How many planes do they lose, though? I forget.
I want to say like six.
Yeah.
Five or six. And these are guys that they just get lost and they go down.
Right.
You know, they just disappear. So it's rather inauspicious start.
Yeah, not a happy start at all.
Mm. It's almost a second flight to nowhere.
Well, it was a flight to nowhere.
Yeah.
So the morning of the 26th of October starts off with, typically, as all carrier battles do, everybody's sending out searches. The U.S., the PBYs, you know, we're relying heavily on the PBYs that are in and around Guadalcanal. These are some of McCain's people, and they're doing a very, very good job. They actually do make, or they try, and they conduct an attack on, is it Zuikaku? I think they drop a torpedo on the
Corsair. I think that's right. And you know, have no luck. But yeah, they're out there all night, you know, kind of skulking around. And some of these birds have got radar now as well. And so, even though Nagumo is trying to, you know, kind of skedaddle out of range, he's never capable of really avoiding all of our scouting assets. But yeah, first light comes up and the carriers are launching scouts too. But yes, we are relying heavily on those PBYs. And it's interesting too, because whereas if you look at the, you know, in the August time frame, the coordination between getting intel from those PBYs and processing that and getting it up the chain of command was terrible. Mm-hmm. And it was terrible at Coral Sea.
It was going through Australia and all kinds of places before it finally got to the people who needed the information.
You know, and the Australians get a real bad rap from that. That was another one of the scapegoats that, you know, Turner tries hauling out as far as mm-hmm. Sabo is concerned. But by the time you fast forward, you know, to October now, things are getting better and those mm-hmm. sighting reports are getting processed more quickly.
Well, I mean, the fact that Kincaid is hearing this or reading this, however you want to look at it, aboard Enterprise within sometimes less than an hour of these reports being sent out by the PBYs, will tell you all you need to know, really, right. At that point.
Yeah, by 1942 standards, that's outstanding.
Oh, heck yeah. And the fact, too, that you know, you just said this just a second ago, that some of these PBYs are equipped with radar, and they are. That's a game changer for huge. The United States, you know, eyeballs at night. I mean, this is a huge, huge, huge deal that the Japanese never came anywhere close to doing it, certainly not in 42.
No. Really, so, yeah, it not until honestly the end of 1944 do you see the same level of proficiency of nighttime scouting using a radar equipped plane. Totally aside here, a recent trip to Kagoshima, they had a kamikaze base there. There mm-hmm. is a Jake that they have started restoring, and you can see that it has radar aerials along the side of it. And so that's cool. Precisely what they were using that plane for. But again, that was 2.5 years after what we're talking about here at Santa Cruz.
Wow. Yep. So Japanese get their scouts, and I'm talking flight deck scouts and cruiser scouts. They get their people in the air first in between 0415 and 0445. They're sending multiple scouts out. Enterprise launches her own scouts at about 0445 as well.
But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter in terms of who puts up aircraft first. I mean, it's really kind of a wash.
It's who finds them first.
Right.
And who hits them first. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of CV-6's scouts saw and approached one of Nagumo's Kate scout planes only 85 miles away from Enterprise, confirming the presence of Japanese carriers. Now,
right.
Kincaid knew that there were carriers in the area, but he didn't know how close they were. Well, if one of your scouters is seeing one of their scouters,
then
you can tell. And it was a Kate, so it wasn't, you know, something that was launched from a cruiser. It's very evident that Japanese carriers are very, very close by. So.
Well, I mean, could be within 200 miles, though, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be that close.
Within 200 miles, but.
Mm-hmm. Strike range.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but if you're building your plans on the basis of capability rather than intent, you should be very concerned.
That's right.
Yeah.
That is also very true.
Yeah.
So First Blood, let's talk about First Blood. Bucky Lee is a guy who's the skipper of Scouting Squadron 10. Again, this is off Enterprise. Enterprise sends out her scouts long before Hornet ever really does much of anything in this battle until she starts sending out her strike. Bucky Lee spots Nagumo's carriers at 0650. So he makes the first American naval aviator eyeball, you know, contact with the Japanese long before anybody else does. He tries to climb to make an attack. And this is similar to what happens at Eastern Solomons. Every one of these scouts are carrying at least a 500 pound bomb. I think they're all carried 500 pounders and they're two little wing mounted 100 pounders and SPDs. And they're making these little pinprick little, you know, dribs and drabs and little bitty attacks, which at least at Eastern Solomons, it didn't do squat, but it does do something here. Lee is driven away, by the way. Let's be clear. Lee is driven away. However, there's a guy that if you listen to our Eastern Solomons episode, you heard his name. He's got a unique name by the name of Bernie Strong, Stockton Bernie Strong. Bernie Strong is, as I said, he was a very confident naval aviator, very self-confident naval aviator.
As they often were.
As they all are, even to this day.
Yeah.
Arrogant, there's other words, but go ahead.
But he could back it up. He's in the air. His radioman by the name of Clarence Garlow, he hears Bucky Lee's report, the sighting report, jots it down and reports the contact to his pilot. Now, this is important to note that this is how SBDs work. There's a radio man in the back seat with a
head. He's also a gunner.
He's also a gunner. But his main job when they're not in combat is to monitor that radio and send contact reports and the like. The pilot is not hearing any of this jazz. He's just driving the bird. It's when the radio receives it and navigating. But when he receives that report, he flips on the intercom in the airplane and says, oh, hey, skipper, here's a and all this jazz. Instantly, as soon as he hears this, Bernie is, he starts jotting down the position locations and start doing navigation on his kneeboard. And this guy has, he proved it at Eastern Solomons and he proves it again here. He was born one of those people with a compass in the end of his nose. He jots this down, and within 15, I think, is it 15? Yeah, 15 minutes, boom, makes a turn, lands right on top of Japanese carrier force.
Yeah, these guys were using kneeboards with wind triangles. I mean, they didn't, it was very rudimentary navigation, and it was remarkable how precise they could be.
Yeah, if they were good at it.
If they were good at it.
But no, it really is just terrifying when you think about the incredibly low quality of the navigational aids they're using in these earlier battles. It's just
I learned how to navigate that way early when I was a civilian pilot. And it ain't easy.
No, it's not easy. But yeah, in any case, yes, he shows up and he and his squadron proceed to do a real number on Shokaku.
At the same time as he's receiving this message, everybody else in that area is receiving this message too.
Right.
So the other Enterprise scouters that are in that area all start, they start gravitating towards this area. One of the guys that's here is a guy named Martin Carmody. They call him Red Carmody. They try to make an attack on Zuiho, and they are driven off by Cap. But kind of like what happened at Midway, where other instances allow other people to make free attacks. This allows Bernie Strong and his wingman by the name of Irvine to make a free attack on Zuiho. And it's just, it's these two SPDs. They're approaching, and the Cap is chasing Red Carmody off. They're running after Red Carmody. They don't even see Strong and Irvine approach. Diving from 14,000 feet at 0740, Strong is popping in. Now, remember, he's an SPD. He's doing 75, 80 degrees, maybe more.
Right.
In this dive, 250 miles an hour, at 30 seconds, he's dropping like a rock. He's popping in and out of clouds. And as the last cloud parts, he's 1,500 feet above Zuiho.
Beautiful. Right there. Right there.
Couldn't have planned it better if he tried, which, of course, he did try.
Yeah.
he drops his bomb. Irvine right behind him drops his bomb. Boom, boom. Two 500 pounders hit Zuiho within seconds.
Yep.
And she's a little carrier, but unlike Ryujo that winds up getting sunk at Eastern Solomon, Zuiho absorbs these, and she doesn't go down, does she, Don?
No. She's got a 15 meter hole in her flight deck. Obviously she's not going to be any good for operations anymore, but
so it's a mission kill.
It's a mission kill, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's heavily damaged, but you have to say that Japanese damage control is better in this battle, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're really, really scared about using their hangars now to service aircraft, and so they're doing most of their deck operations, particularly the fueling of aircraft, is all handled on the flight deck.
But that's got to slow down cycle time in flight operations, doesn't it?
Yeah, but the downside is worse than the upside, which is not turning your carrier into a funeral pyre.
Exactly.
So, but the bottom line is that Zuiho is now out of the fight, and what that does, the Japanese doctrine for these smaller carriers really was to use them primarily as combat air patrol assets. That the new organization of a Japanese carrier division was to have two big flight decks and a carrier like Zuiho. And Zuiho was just to be beefing up the Cap so that the big carriers could go about their business, which is mostly offensive and strike-oriented.
That's very interesting, and that's that makes sense, because most of the combat air patrol all the combat air patrol that's chasing off Bucky Lee, that's chasing off Red Carmody, they're all coming from Zuiho.
There you go.
And those planes have to land somewhere, and they can't land on Zuiho anymore.
Right. And they've got enough flex capacity in the bigger flight decks that those guys are going to have some place to land. But it's a problem in terms of the overall fleet air defense, issue for that task force. Mm-hmm.
So Bernie Strong avenges his screw up from Eastern Solomons. You know, he's the one that spots Ryujo at Eastern Solomons, and he neglects to attack. Mm-hmm. He lands back aboard Enterprise with his ordnance, and he gets basically, he doesn't get basically, he gets chewed out by Enterprise's air officer, John Cromlin. They called him Uncle John. Cromlin basically just berates Bernie Strong, for like, you had this opportunity. This is your chance of glory, and you
right
it up, you know, you screwed yeah it up.
And as Strong, Wayne Gretzky would say, yeah, you know, you miss 100% of the shots that you don't take.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And that, yep, that stuck with a dude like Bernie Strong. And he said before he got in that cockpit, he said, if I see one, he says, I'm going to bring this sucker down. We're going to hit it. So help me God.
Right. Right.
And it's not to be underestimated or understated, I should say. No, it doesn't sink this little ship, but it knocks her out. And that's one less flight deck that the United yep States has to worry about here.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And from a larger perspective, one of the things that you see in carrier battles is you always want to have redundancy in flight decks, mm-hmm, right? It just gives you more fallback options. And so, yeah, she ain't a fleet carrier, but as you say, that's just it's one less place to put airplanes if I need to. Yeah. So she's out.
Yeah, she's gone. At 0658, almost 7 o'clock in the morning, Japanese scouts spot the Hornet. Now, this is where the big boys come into play. This is where right Shokaku and Zuikaku start getting ready for action. John, take us through some of the flight leaders here. Despite the fact that the United States spotted the Japanese first, it's the IJN that gets off their strike first. Not right really surprising here.
Not surprising, given the proficiency of Japanese deck operations. They're so good at this, being able to put up a deck load strike and get this thing warmed up and get it, not only get it off the deck, but get it into the air and formed up into a, you know, reasonably cohesive package and off. We've talked a little bit about some of the leaders that were there. I mean, again, Seki, you know, great pilot. Murata, great pilot. List some of the others, I guess I would say. Go for it.
So, well, I mean, Murata, he like you said, this is the cat that attacked Battleship Row. He hit the West Virginia, did he?
I think that's right. Yeah, Murata, you know, by common acclaim, was the torpedo plane yeah pilot in
the world. Navy.
Yeah, in the world. And certainly at the time of Midway, he did not participate at Midway. He was on Akagi. He was one of the reserve strike force gentlemen there. Mm-hmm. But Akagi's torpedo plane squadron during that battle was composed 100% of Pearl Harbor veterans, and Murata being the most, you know, veteran of all of them. So this is a cat that you do not want lining up on your ship if you are on the receiving end of one of his attacks. Yeah, very, very dangerous. Knows what he's doing.
So their strike, the Japanese strike, is set up like you talked about at Midway. One carrier sends dive bombers, one carrier sends torpedo bombers. And yep, this is exactly what they're doing here, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. And that, again, that sort of an organization facilitates their spotting operations. It's just easier to haul out, you know, one type of one, you know, type of bird, get it up there and get them armed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what you're seeing here.
And there's great doctrinal appeal by doing that as well, just from the loading and maintenance standpoint.
Right. Right.
So as the Japanese strike is on its way, it's launched and they get it out of there damn quick, like the Japanese always do. It's on the way, full bore, heading towards the last reported area of USS Hornet. It passes the strike, two American strikes are inbound to the Japanese location, or last known Japanese location of the fleet carrier, Shokaku and Zuikaku. One is a very, very small strike by Enterprise, because keep in mind, Enterprise had launched a lot of scouts out, Bernie Strong, right, people like that. So they did not have a lot of airplanes aboard to put a
attack missions at this point in time.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, they didn't have the birds, you know.
Yeah. Although this is something that we see throughout this particular battle, is just sort of the fragmented nature of American air power. Mm-hmm. The strike assets are going out in penny packets, again, very similar to Midway, you know, squadron sized chunks or even sub squadron sized chunks. I forget how many different packets of air power the Americans have in the air at one time here, but it's six or seven, or, you know, it's absurd. we still can't concentrate our air power. This is a huge problem.
This is a massive problem. And this is, in my opinion, what almost causes us to really screw this event up,
right?
Is we didn't have enough aircraft over the target at one time. And
right.
Again, Midway, we're not going to talk about that again, but it was a lot of luck that involved.
Yes.
That's why everybody was there at the same time. This is just poor organization. This is
correct.
Poor execution.
Correct.
From both carriers now.
Yeah.
You know, Hornet's a new girl to the street, but Enterprise ain't. And,
right.
And this is just not good organization. This is not good leadership aboard the ships. And it's a mess.
It's funny because after World War II, this new science called operations analysis was birthed. And part of operations analysis was to model the complexity of things like what you just said, Seth. And the point is, when you double the amount of aircraft over a defending target, it doesn't just nearly double the complexity of defense. It's actually 2 to the 3rd power. It's nonlinear in making it more complex. And so when we have these kind of piecemeal attacks, you would think, oh, well, it was twice as easy for the Japanese. No, it was significantly easier for the Japanese to defend against.
Right.
And so this was a big deal. And it was both a failure of understanding, the attack scenarios and planning for them, as well as a failure of execution.
Yeah.
No, and that's a really good point, that if you look at, you know, which is more difficult to defend against, a 24 plane package coming in all at once or 3 8 plane packages, the 24 plane is by far the more
Absolutely.
Dangerous. It swamps the defenses, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Although the Japanese are sort of guilty of some of this too, in that at the same time this is all going on, Junyo has launched an 18 plane strike to go down and bomb Henderson Field, mm-hmm. which is a subtraction from Japan's air power that could have been devoted to going after our carriers. You know, I don't know why that went down, but in any case,
they were afraid of Henderson Field, the unsinkable aircraft carrier, right?
That's what I was going to say. I think that they were so preoccupied at this point, and you're the Japanese expert here, John, but I mean, they were so preoccupied with the thought that, oh crap, Henderson Field is going to launch, you know, whatever the hell they had, and come and sink us. That's why they did that. You know, I mean,
Although
you can't blame them.
18 aircraft is relatively marginal to the task, though, trying to put an airfield out of commission.
Sometimes you just want to keep their head down.
Yeah, I mean, you're quite right. You know, if we flash back to Eastern Solomons, you know, that was a battle that they kind of thought that they had won. And yet the remaining air power that was sitting on Henderson Field ends up trashing their troop convoy after that battle was officially over and negated, you know, any of the benefits that they might have gotten. So at this point, yes, the Japanese have a very healthy respect for the Cactus Air Force and the assets that are sitting on that airfield. Of course, they're also getting erroneous information from the Imperial Army regarding, you know, have you captured this airfield or not?
Yes,
you know,
we have.
First they said, yes,
no, we haven't.
Actually we didn't, you know, so yeah, that's a mess.
We had a great conversation about that in our last episode.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do send out a message at 2300 hours saying, you know, we have captured Henderson. Well, we've captured the airfield, which,
right.
Of course, they did not.
Did not. Anyway.
As the American strike from Enterprise, which is actually ahead of the strike from Hornet, passes the Japanese strike heading to Hornet, the fighter escort from the strike, which come from Zuiho, break off and attack the American strike. They hit the TBF Avengers hard. Now, as we'll see with the Hornet strike that's launched is without fighter escort. The Enterprise strike, and I talked all glowingly about Fighting Squadron 10, is escorted by F-4Fs from Fighting Squadron 10. Now, why the hell don't the F-4Fs attack? Well, they do, but why don't they stop this attack? They're escorting these TBFs and these SBDs, which are incredibly slow, and they're making S-turns, and the fighters are literally on the outward S-turn leg, the outer leg of their turn, when the Japanese fighters hit them, and before they can pull back, the Zeros are through. Boom! They've already blasted through the formation. So it's a mess. Enterprise strike takes a pretty hard lick, and she winds up not doing any effective damage to, with the exception of Bernie Strong and Irvine, any effective damage to the Japanese fleet because of this, because there are events that are going to unfold here in just a few minutes from your friend Seki that do some significant damage to the Big E.
Yeah.
Now at 0850, Hornet Strike spots Shikaku. And Hornet Strike is, as I said, it's mostly SBDs and TBFs. There are no F4, F Wildcats with them. The strike is being led by a guy named Gus Widhelm. Right. Widhelm is the strike leader. He's also a Bombing Squadron 8 skipper. Gus Widhelm is a veteran of the early hit and run raids from Yorktown. He was at Coral Sea. He hits Shoho and I believe Shokaku again at Coral Sea. As he's bringing his strike in, they are lit up by Japanese combat air patrol. These guys are on them like white on rice, man. Widhelm gets shot down. He's later picked up.
That's but right.
He does get shot down. At the tail end of the formation is a guy that I knew, and I believe you knew him too, John Clay Fisher from Bombing Squadron 8.
Yeah, I corresponded with Clay when he was still alive. He was part of the Midway roundtable group. Roundtable. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Clay Fisher's bringing up the tail end, and this is the guy that I referred to earlier. He's classified as a veteran because he's flown a couple missions. He flew the afternoon strike on Hiryu. It wound up attacking, I think, one of the cruisers or battleships in the formation. I don't remember which.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. And then he was on the Maekuma Mogami strike on the 6th. But this is his... Say again?
He went over after Haruna at Midway. Anyway, yeah, sorry, tanking details.
And he's bringing up the rear end of this formation right now. And I remember him telling me that when he said, or when he heard, that there was no fighter escort, that he told me, he said this, that I thought that this was a suicide mission.
Mm-hmm.
We ain't coming back. And that very nearly happens. As he's bringing in his SBD, he watches Widhelm go down. He is lit up from behind by at least two, if not three, Zeros coming. They're making slicing passes at him. He takes a 20 millimeter shell in the back of the armor plate right above, right behind his head, that passes within a whisker of his radioman gunner's head, shatters against the armor plate and sprays the inside of the cockpit with shrapnel. He takes one through the elbow and I think one in the leg.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean,
that's amazing that he,
by that much.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause the armor plate on an SBD is not going to stop a 20 millimeter shell. It'll take a 50 cal, but that's about all it's going to do. Yeah.
I think more, it was more of a ricochet that bounced off the side of the armor plate, frankly.
Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he told me, he said, when it exploded, and clearly it was something large, it hit it, but when it exploded, he said it felt like somebody hit him in the back of the head with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
That it was just a smack. And he literally went dark for a couple seconds. He got hit. And that's actually what woke him up, was the pain in his arm because he took some shrapnel through his arm.
Right.
He immediately says, this ain't going to happen. He drops his bomb and gets the hell out of there. Mm. In the process, he's popping through cloud cover, jinking, trying to get away from the fighters that are relentlessly chasing him down. And again, these are some of the finest naval aviators in the world. And I'm talking about the Zero pilots that are trying to kill this man.
Right.
I'm not sure here, and he's unsure too. At one point, he pops out of a cloud and he looks to his left and there's a Zero flying wing on him. And the pilot just looks at him and they share glances and Clay's like, I'm dead. That's it. This guy's going to pull up behind me. I'm a goner. At that moment, his rear seat gunner, I believe his name was Ferguson, that comes to, grabs his twin 30s and just literally just one arms it and sprays in the direction of the Zero. And the Zero's like, all right, fine.
Peels off.
Yeah.
Right.
Peels off and gets away.
And now, some of that may have had to do too, you know, we don't know who that Zero pilot is. It may have been out of cannon ammo. I mean, that was one of the things that the Zero had a real problem with, was American birds were tough and they were hard to bring down. And it was really tough to bring them down just using your 7.7 millimeters. You really wanted to hit him with a cannon. And yet the Zero only carried about 60 rounds for each one of its two cannons. So it's very possible that that guy might have already expended his cannon ammo shooting down some other dudes, and he's out. He's just kind of assessing the situation. But if he takes, you know, fire from that potential victim, it ain't worth it. I'll bug out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it was very evident that Clay's Dauntless was hit bad. I mean, you know, it was full of holes, full of holes. Yeah. Despite taking heavy casualties in the strike, Hornet strike takes heavy casualties. They do some damage to Chicago again, right? John, can you lay it on us what happens here?
The Japanese accounts are not clear as to the number of bombs that actually hit the ship. It's at least four. It may have been six, but they're all concentrated mostly in the rear of the flight deck, and they just make a shambles out of the rear flight deck. It's several of the sections of the flight deck have been, you know, shoved up, so there's, you know, a meter worth of gap. I mean, there's no way that this carrier is going to be conducting flight operations. Given that amount of punishment, I mean, it really is kind of astonishing that she is not sunk. It takes them 5 hours to put out the fires aboard her. And at this, during this entire time, she is steaming at 28 knots, beaten feet to get out of there. Nagumo, the force commander, is still aboard her, but her condition is considered dire enough that he does not request to transfer his flag during that entire run as she's getting out of the neighborhood. It's only after, I think, 4 hours that he's like, can we slow down long enough that, you know, we can pull a tin can alongside and I can move my flag over there? So, yeah, they're definitely concerned about her, but she is a very tough ship. I mean,
clearly.
Say what you will about the, you know, how well the Yorktown class were built. I think you have to give the same props to Shokaku and Zuikaku. I think for just sheer ability to take punishment, they are the two finest carriers of the Japanese inventory.
And, you know, I think this goes back to your point that you stated when we started this, is that the Japanese damage control had evolved significantly from June to now.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is really passive damage control, in the fact that we just Shokaku did not have a lot of aircraft below in the hangar deck. There were a couple of torpedo planes, one of which miraculously doesn't get destroyed, even though she's, you know, sitting on the rear of the flight deck during this whole thing. But yeah, just the act of getting those aircraft out of the hangars. And most of them are up in the air at this point. That does worlds for your damage control. But it is also clear that from a firefighting perspective, yeah, they do a much better job than what you saw at Midway.
And that's learning on the fly, learning the hard way. But I mean, you know, this is the second time Chicago's taken a beating.
Yes.
And this is by far significantly worse than she suffered at Coral Sea.
Yeah, although her damage at Coral Sea was sufficient that they were concerned about her capsizing en route back to Japan. Yeah, no, she was in a bad way. But yeah, in terms of just punishment, number of bombs that come down, because again, these are 1,000-pound weapons. You know, that's a really big beating. But this carrier is now going to be out of action for the next. She's in the yards for 5 months. She is not going to return to action until May of 1943. So that's a big blow.
Yeah, that's a significant loss. Significant loss. While all this is happening, almost at the same time, your boys from Chicago are approaching Hornet. Hornet receives word of the inbound strike from her outbound strike. They say, hey, yep, you got company coming, and they're coming.
Yeah.
get the home fires burning, because they're coming.
Yeah.
And this is, again, this is very confusing from my perspective, from anybody who studies, you know, especially the later things that happened in the American Carrier Force. The poor coordination of the Combat Air Patrol is really what causes Hornet to go down. Now, the United States, we've got something like 40 some odd aircraft in the air as combat air patrol. This is why Hornet strike didn't have any F-4Fs,
right?
Because they kept them there to ward off the Japanese strike that they knew would be coming.
And this isn't the first time this has happened, right? Yeah, so it keeps happening.
It happened at Eastern Solomons. Almost said it happened in Santa Cruz. Well, yeah, no kidding. But it It happened the same thing at Eastern Solomons. Poor fighter director operations from both ships, mind you, but specifically Enterprise. Now, I love me some Big E, but she's the one that screwed this up.
We talked about this before, but the doctrine is that the fighters, the cap is standing out and supposed to attrit the inbound, squadrons to the point where when it becomes point defense, which is where the ship's self-defense guns pick up the fight, you don't want your own fighters in being shot at by your own guns. But they almost attrit. What did they shoot anything down?
No, they do. Yeah. They do. They lay a pretty good lick on the Japanese, but again, had all the airborne combat air patrol been vectored in the proper way, and Hornet was the one that was giving the right directions, by the way, sorry, Enterprise, but that's the truth. Had they been vectored to the proper location at the proper altitude at the proper time, I'm not saying that all of them would have been shot down, but a lot more would have been.
The other thing to realize, too, is that this is an actual combined arms attack on the part of the Japanese. They've got both dive bombers and torpedo planes coming in at different altitudes. And so this is a much more complex problem to solve from an air defense standpoint. But I'm with you, Seth. Yeah, mistakes were made. The results are dire.
Putting it mildly.
Yeah.
Now, Hornet, obviously, she realizes that she is going to be the target of this attack. Cap engages at about 15 miles away from Hornet, which is too damn close, frankly, for combat air patrol to engage in inbound
strike.
You need to
be 30 miles away, at least.
At least, right. Exactly. Ship dials up 31 knots.
Which is incredible.
Right.
Hornet says, I'm out of here.
Right. Yeah, she somehow found a way to go downhill in the ocean.
Yeah.
I mean, she is getting after it.
Yeah. Considering her bottom has not been scraped terribly recently either. Right. That's a commendable top speed.
And people may not understand that that takes off 2 to 3 knots off your tendons, top end speed. Submarines too, by the way.
Mm-hmm. They had the oars out. They were rowing. Mm-hmm. they were getting out of there. But it doesn't really matter, because she's attacked by the Vals first. The first couple of Vals miss, but then they start. These are Seki's people, are they not?
These are Seki's people, yeah. They've got some real pros here. Another guy that's in this attack is a Lieutenant Sakamoto Akira, who, not widely known, but this is the guy who led the attack against Wheeler Field during Pearl Harbor. He drops the first bomb of the Pacific War. It's because Wheeler gets hit before the naval anchorage. Yeah. So you can make an argument that Sakamoto, is the guy who started the war.
Well, the civilian airplane shot down north of Oahu.
Yeah. There's any number of ways we can slice that, but nevertheless, another.
He drops the first ordnance at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah,
he does.
Correct. Yeah. This is a very experienced dive bomber group, and the results reflect that. Yeah, they hit her 3 times, and some of these hits are absolutely. They're devastating. I mean, one of them kills 60 guys when it comes in. It's very bad news.
And the rapidity with which she is hit, it's literally, it's like boom, 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 boom. I mean, it's and that is the sign of a very well-executed dive bombing attack.
I mean, these guys are coming down in, 10-second intervals or something like that. They're peeling over very close together. I don't know about the loadout of their ordnance. It had been Japanese doctrine that a certain, like about a third of the bombs that they would drop would actually be HE contact fused to detonate on the flight deck, because you wanted to kill the anti-aircraft gunners. And you saw that happening at Eastern Solomons. That was a factor there.
Killed 20-something gunners.
Yeah, right. I'm not clear on whether or not that was still the case, whether that was standard.
But also, it would destroy an airplane still on deck as well, and the flight deck crew.
Right.
So, all those reasons.
But the bottom line is that Hornet is very, very heavily hit as a result of that. And at the tail end of that dive bomber attack, almost as soon as that's over, here come the torpedo planes too.
Yeah. And they conduct a perfect hammer and anvil strike, which you know basically means there's no place to run. You can't you can't evade by turning starboard or port because torpedoes are coming in from both
directions.
Angles. Yeah.
That's correct. And a lot of people have this sort of mistaken notion that, you know, it's really the speed of the torpedo that is sort of the deciding factor as to whether or not it's an effective weapon here. It's really not. It's the tactical deployment of that torpedo. If you can initiate an attack like that, it doesn't really matter what the speed of that torpedo is. There are no good solutions as far as Hornet is concerned.
Regardless of its speed, it's faster than the carrier.
Correct. Or at least equivalent. So yeah, Hornet ends up collecting two of those as well. And at this point, you know, she's desperately hurt. She's not doomed yet, but she's coasting to a stop. Her engineering spaces are a mess. She's on fire. You know, the real determining factor here for Hornet is going to be whether or not she can get herself back under power in a reasonable amount of time, not only for the sake of propulsion, but also for the sake of firefighting. So that's kind of the outstanding question of the hour. But, you know, at this point, yeah, she's a mess and she needs all the assistance she can get and all the top cover she can get. And yeah, that's a problem at this point.
Yeah.
The downside, of course, for the Japanese is some of the casualties that are extracted as a result of this attack. Seki is shot down. Murata is shot down. Sakamoto is shot down.
This is by gunfire, not by the cap?
Primarily gunfire. You know, the Hornet did not have the Bofors yet, but she does have...
Very few of the ships had the Bofors at this point.
Yeah, that's correct. But, you know, a lot of people kind of poo-poo the 1.1-inch, but, you know, at short range, it could definitely chop a dive bomber in half and discard it. And we see that happening. That certainly happened at Midway. Again, Yorktown's 1.1s were pretty effective. And you know, Hornet also has a number of 5-inch, and she's got Juno in the neighborhood and other ships as well.
So,
there's a lot of boom-boom here. The Americans are very good at this.
Juno is, and that's important to note too, is that, you know, if you look at her, and I dig my nose back up, but if you look at her escort, you've got, as I said, you've got two light cruisers, two heavy cruisers, and six destroyers. I mean, that's a lot of ships. It's a lot of anti-aircraft power. But the key is that one of those ships is the anti-aircraft cruiser Juno.
This thing, 16 5-inch 38 guns.
Yeah. I mean, she was built to do this.
To do this thing. Yeah. A lot of people don't understand, you know, the 5-inch 38 is hands down the finest heavy anti-aircraft gun of the war.
Yep.
I mean, the only thing that comes even remotely close to it is maybe the German twin 128 millimeter Flak. But
did we have the proximity fuse at this point?
No. Proximity fuse doesn't happen for another year or so, but you do have the Mark 37 director, which is a fine piece of equipment. Fully tachyometric and is one of the few pieces of equipment, you know, in terms of anti-aircraft fire direction that is really at least reasonably capable of dealing with a dive bomber. It can handle the vertical rate changes that dive bombers create. You know, there aren't a lot of anti-aircraft fire control systems out in the world that can do this. So the result is that particularly in terms of heavy gunfire, the 5-inch in particular, is lethal. And the 5-inch has a really high rate of fire too. In a trained crew, you can get 20 rounds per minute out of that thing over short time periods. You know, you can't sustain it, but 3 or 4 minutes, I can do 16 to 20 rounds out of that thing. That's absurd. You know, most 5-inch guns are doing a third to a half of that.
You're putting up a wall of lead.
Yeah, there's a
the
lot
plane's got to fly through.
It's impressive.
Yeah. And they're throwing up a lot of lead, but you know, one thing two things we failed to mention here. And as far as Hornet's attack is concerned, she's hit twice by aircraft. One of the vowels that dive on Hornet, and there's some very famous series of photographs.
What you mean is she's two aircraft crash into her.
Correct.
Yeah.
The valve that's coming down in the famous pictures, there's a series, I think. Well, there's certainly three. Two. There's three. Yeah. Is there three?
I think there are three.
And you can see it's hit. Like, I don't know if the pilot said, you know what, I'm doing this. Or I personally, if my impression that the pilot was dead.
That's possible.
That he was dead. He was in his dive. He got hit and he was either dead or wounded. Right. And it just, boom, it glances off of the stack of Hornet. And
I'm going to disagree with you on that, Seth. Because when you're dead, your foot's going to fall, your rudder's going to go over, the plane's going to veer. He was controlling that aircraft, right?
He might have been, but if you look at the pictures, and I'm going to show them in the video, by the time you see the flame coming out of the aircraft and the time it hits Hornet, I mean, you're talking 1, maybe 2 seconds.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's boom, boom. Mm-hmm. But then she's hit again by another Val. This thing drops its ordnance, and I'm not sure if it's one of the ones that hit Hornet or not, but this airplane comes around the bow.
This is very intentional.
This is intentional. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. This is very clear.
It comes around and it hits the port side bow, as I recall, right?
That's correct.
And in fact, later when the ship was discovered, you can kind of see the wing penetration marks in the side of the hull.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
2017, I think it was.
This was a very definite suicide crash by this pilot here. Mm-hmm. And do we know who the pilot was?
We'd have to go through Lundstrom's books, but he may have identified him there. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But regardless, she takes two aircraft hits on top of the ordnance that she absorbs here.
Yeah.
So at 9:25, the attack is over. Hornet's dead in the water. And you said, John, that the big thing was getting power back up. They actually start to restore power, and the fires are under control by 10. But the power that they restore is not enough to get her engines back online, and that's the key thing here.
Yeah,
that's the key.
So she's still dead in the water.
Yeah, yeah, she's got juice, but not enough power to get the boilers lit off, to get everything to go.
So they're trying to get Northampton along to do a tow.
Right,
because that's the next thing. You get a cruiser that's got sufficient horsepower to get her out of there. Mm. But rigging up a tow is going to be difficult.
And they rigged up the tow, if I'm not mistaken, they rigged up the tow, I want to say like 3 or 4 times. And Hornet kept breaking the line because she was swishing and swashing because of the torpedo hits.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Yeah, she shipped a lot of water, so she's heavier than she should be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. While all this is occurring.
Yeah.
It's still not done yet. Enterprise comes under attack. The Japanese Val spot CV-6 at 10 o'clock. They commence their attack at about 10:15. Lieutenant, and help me here, Keiichi Arima? Is that properly?
Keiichi Arima. Mm-hmm.
Keiichi That's Arima. Right. This is another Pearl Harbor veteran, is it not?
Yes, I believe he is, yeah.
Yeah, and this is another bad dude here. This guy also hit Enterprise 2 months before at Easter Solomons.
Right.
He lines up on the Big E, and yet again.
And actually, I misspoke. This is Seki's attack here that's coming in.
It sure is. It is Seki's attack.
Yeah.
But Arima is part of this attack. And,
correct.
And he plants a bomb again on the Enterprise. This one's not nearly the one that he dropped at Eastern Solomons, I believe, is the one that you see in the famous footage that it explodes on the flight deck.
That one was near the elevator, as I recall.
Yeah.
This one's near the bow.
Yeah, yeah, it punches through the bow and shatters. Well, it doesn't shatter. It splatters the Enterprise's bow with shrapnel. There's pictures of that. You'll see. I mean, it looks like Swiss cheese, the bow of the aircraft carrier does. Minutes later, she's hit again. The Enterprise is hit again near the after portion of the forward elevator, exploding in the hangar deck, killing 40 guys.
Right.
So this is the second time in 2 months that Enterprise has taken a heavy beating from dive bombers. One really, really cool story here. It's a very important story too, is a story of a guy named William Pinkney. Anybody who knows about the United States Navy in World War II knows that probably of all service branches, the U.S. Navy was the most segregated service branch.
That's correct.
In the military. Exactly.
Yep.
And it wasn't
William Pinkney would have been a cook or a officer's steward.
He was a cook. He was a cook. Little bitty dude too, like little bitty guy. He was like, they just said he was
135 pounds,
maybe of slight build. He's a little bitty fella. He is stationed below decks. His battle station, it was part of a DC party. He was part of the DC party aboard Enterprise. He's in the vicinity where these bombs explode. He braves the fires, the smoke, all the fumes and all the acrid crap that's burning in the inside of this aircraft carrier. Little bitty dude starts hauling guys up three decks of ladders on his back.
Evacuating wounded, right.
Pulling people out of the ship. Mm-hmm. In the process, he eventually passes out, suffers smoke inhalation, and third-degree burns by doing this. Mm-hmm. This dude risked life and limb and performed as well or better, frankly, than some of the people in his area. You know, willingly risked his life to save those who, I'm not saying they all thought he was inferior, but, you know, guys that probably would have looked down on him, he saved their ass.
He did. And I think he was the second Navy Cross ever awarded to an African-American, the first being Doris Miller,
who was
on West Virginia during Pearl Harbor.
And he's a guy that I guarantee you, if there's, you know, 100 people that are listening to this statement at this very second, 99 of you have no idea who the hell he is.
Yeah.
And hopefully you do now.
Right.
Hopefully you do now.
Important story. And as we're sitting here, we're writing a book about the USS Indianapolis African-American crew called Heroes in the Shadows. And that's what William Pinckney was. He was a hero in the shadows.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. But that's not all. Enterprise is hit by no.
Why would it be? Yeah.
When the Japanese bring it, they bring it. She's hit by she's not actually hit by this third bomb. This third bomb is what I like to call a tooth rattling, and I know all about teeth at the present time. Tooth rattling near miss, but it does spring hull plates. She starts leaking more fuel, more oil. By 10:20, mercifully, the attack is over. At 10:35, the Val attack, mind you. At 10:35, Cates arrive. And this is one of the instances where the Combat Air Patrol
actually does its.
It actually does its job. Yeah. One of the guys aloft is my old buddy, Swede Vetiza. During the attack on Hornet, he was already aloft as Combat Air Patrol. He's one of the Enterprise pilots that managed to get over to Hornet's side. He shoots down a Val in this one before Hornet is hit, or while Hornet is hit. And he also shoots down one of the Vals that attacks CV-6. So he gets two in this one very mission. As he's circling around the area, trying to line up on these Cates, he gets a radio vector that, you know, there's inbound torpedo planes on Enterprise. I think it's off her port quarter that he comes in on these people on this side. Being the expert that he was, he switches off his two outboard guns and his F4F to conserve ammunition because he knew he was going to have to do some very, very precise shooting.
Interesting.
I mean, the guy, if you knew the guy,
he's a pro. Yeah.
He's the consummate pro.
Yeah.
He switches off his outboard guns to conserve ammunition and literally just starts picking off the Cates one by one. He starts at the back of the formation, drops one, drops another, drops another, drops another, drops another. In this mission, he winds up shooting down seven aircraft. He's got seven confirmed kills in this one mission alone. It's a record that still stands to this day.
Mm-hmm. And he was a 15-second ace. That has to be a record that still stands this day, too.
A little more than 15 seconds, but it also gives you an indication of just how vulnerable the Cate was. Again, we do not have self-sealing fuel tanks on this bird. We've got a single 7.7 millimeter machine gun on the back of this bird. They probably weren't terribly good at group fire in the way that a lot of the SBD crewmen knew that if you could bunch up, you know, you got twin 30s in the back of each of these planes. This is a very dangerous formation to approach. Mm-hmm. A formation of Cates is not at all. If you're a fighter aircraft, he knows what you're doing. And Sweet obviously did. Yeah,
he certainly does. Yeah. He gets up on his last target, which is another Cate. And this is interesting and this is important too. Now he shoots it up, but this thing doesn't go down. Well, at least it doesn't go down by Swede's guns. The aircraft is piloted by a guy named Takei Kiyomi. Have you ever run across this name before?
I'm not. Yeah. And I'm not an individual Japanese fighter, pilot kind of guy. Yeah.
He might have been a new guy. You know, I don't know, but Kiyomi drops down and he's what appears to be lining up on USS South Dakota. And we'll get to South Dakota in a second here, but he flies over top of South Dakota. Why he doesn't drop his torpedo on a battleship, I do not know.
Might have been too close.
Could have been
too close to home.
Because I would imagine that once he starts getting hit by 50 caliber ammunition from Vettis's guns, he probably pours the coal onto that cake and tries to get the hell out of there.
Which was unfortunately the most underpowered plane in the Japanese carrier inventory. But continue.
What he does do is drops his bird down, flies right over Sodak, as I said, and deliberately crashes into the USS Smith. The USS Smith is a little bitty old destroyer. The aircraft explodes, of course, on contact with Smith, slides off of the ship, and then the torpedo that was aboard the aircraft is still on Smith and cooks off. Kaboom.
Right.
Huge fire on the destroyer. The destroyer is commanded by a guy named Lieutenant Commander Hunter Wood. Now, if this guy doesn't have it upstairs, I don't know who does. His ship, his little destroyer, is ablaze on the stern section of the ship from an aircraft, a purposely crashed aircraft, and a torpedo explosion on the back end of the ship. The DDs do not have the firefighting capabilities that carriers and battleships do. So what does he do? He drives his destroyer into the boiling wake of the USS South Dakota.
And he lets the wake water wash up on his ship to put out the fires. I had a hard time believing this story when I first
heard it. It's one of those stories that I'm just like, you're kidding me.
Yeah,
because I kid you not.
I've seen wakes of big ships, and there is a rooster tail sometimes, but I never imagined that it could be above the deck of a old destroyer. But I have to believe.
Yeah. Yeah. From all accounts, he doesn't necessarily drive into the wake. He crosses the wake. And by doing that,
anybody who's ridden a jet ski through the wake of a boat is going to take a shower. And
South Dakota is a relatively large object. And so, they're not necessarily the most streamlined of objects either. There's just a lot of brute force to make that thing go through the water.
But I've never heard of this happening before or since. So,
Yeah,
and the incredible. Remarkable thing about it is, now you got to remember too, this formation of American ships is under attack, so they're all doing flank speed.
Right.
You know, South Dakota's probably kicking close to 30 knots. I mean, she's moving.
28.
Probably. I'm not sure Wood could keep up with her.
That's a lot of water being moved. Remarkable thing about this is after Wood drives his ship through the wake of the battleship, and it does extinguish the flames.
Yep.
He gets back on station and commences firing again.
Right.
That's how it's Hollywood stuff right there.
I mean, that's serious.
This is the combat debut of South Dakota. She puts up remarkable quantities of anti-aircraft fire. She overclaims remarkable numbers of Japanese aircraft shot down as a result. There's no way she shot down 25 planes. I'm sorry.
Done on both sides of the war, right?
Yeah. But, you know, she's one of the few ships that is equipped with the 40-millimeter Bofors, and it is an absolutely awe-inspiring sight when she opens up. Yeah, again, you've got 16 5-inch guns on that ship. She's minus a 5-inch turret on either side because she's equipped as a flagship, so she doesn't have quite as much firepower in the 5-inch department, but still a lot.
It's enough.
Enough, and a lot of Bofors as well. So yeah, she is very capable in terms of screening the Enterprise, and I think you can make an argument that really is the difference here between Enterprise being potentially sunk in this battle as well. So
I agree 150%. There's, in my opinion, there's two things that kept Enterprise from taking torpedoes. She obviously gets hit by the bombs, but there's two things that keep her from getting hit from torpedoes. One is Swede Vettis's 7 aircraft.
That
he shoots down. He was recommended for the Medal of Honor. Does not get it. How, I don't know. Does not get it. He gets his third Navy Cross here. The other thing that keeps Enterprise from getting hit by torpedoes is undoubtedly South Dakota.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly. If you look at the pictures of the event, which I'm going to show, she is, She's right there. She is riding Enterprise's tail the whole time. And that goes to Captain Gatch. You know, in the action that we're going to talk about, the battleship action, he gets a lot of flack for basically overstating what actually happened, lying about what actually happened during the battleship shootout. However, in this instance, he does not. He also gets wounded in the throat by shrapnel from a bomb that hits South Dakota's number one turret.
Yeah,
and that's right. He stands up and says, all right, let's rock and roll, baby.
Yeah, keep on going.
But he's the one that orders that ship to, I mean, she keeps station on Enterprise's stern, you know, alternating between a couple thousand yards. But I mean, she's right there the whole damn time.
Yeah. If we take it back up a big picture, though, the Americans are in the hurt basket at this point. You know, Enterprise is not in a good way at all. Mm-hmm. Hornet is dead in the water, and we need to try to tow her out of here. So pretty clearly at this point, you know, the Japanese have a tremendous advantage in latent firepower in that. Junyo is still capable. Zuikaku is still capable. And that's what's going to happen to us next is mm-hmm. you know, follow-up strikes.
So you'd mentioned that Northampton's trying to tow, and we talked about she broke the lines a few times. She actually does get a tow line connected to her, and they are making way 5 knots.
5 knots, trying to haul her out of there.
That's pretty good, actually, right, for tow?
When you think about it, yeah.
Yeah, but now, unfortunately, the last strike of the day is coming in, and it is coming in from probably the least valued carrier in the Japanese inventory. And so Tony Tully, my esteemed co-author for Shattered Sword, we have arguments over this all the time, because I'm like, Junyo and Hiyo, those ships were scows, you know, just awful. And Tony has this soft place in his heart for both of them, you know. And this is the one moment when Junyo really shines, because she gets in the last lick of this battle, and it's telling. Mm-hmm. Comes in with a torpedo strike against Hornet, finds her dead in the water, and unfortunately, Juno has been temporarily detached from the formation and is out of position, not there to screen her. And so Junyo's strike comes in, and they hit Hornet, and one torpedo, but it hits in the engineering spaces where you just did not want to get hit. Mm-hmm. And that puts paid to Hornet. It's all over at this point. She's not going to be able to, you know, get up to speed. And at this point, the Americans know it's likely that the Japanese are going to come gunning for them with surface forces during the evening.
And they can't be sticking around to save this carrier that's not going to. Yeah. So it becomes an anchor. And they're able to conduct a pretty organized abandoned ship process, when the decision's made to scuttle her.
Yeah.
And so she, shockingly small loss of life.
Yeah. I mean, it's
too much.
Yeah. Still. For the beating that she took. Yeah.
Right.
She, yeah.
Yeah.
And we have another instance here of, you know, Americans trying to scuttle their own ship and not having a lot of luck. They try with their torpedoes. Of course, the American destroyer torpedoes are just as terrible as our submarine torpedoes. And so those don't work. And then they try shelling her, and that takes, you know, umpty hundred rounds. And
400 rounds.
And she's on fire, but she won't go down. So, and eventually, you know.
She's still floating when the Japanese find her, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, like the American destroyers sight Japanese destroyers coming in. They're like, bye.
We're out of here.
You know, and
the Japanese. By that time, the crew's been abandoned and recovered.
Yes. So
there's no reason to stick around.
Right.
The Japanese took some artist drew an image of her right before she went down.
Yes.
At night, I think, illuminated by searchlights.
They were very, very pleased to see the number 8 on her funnel. Noted that with satisfaction. You know, here's the plane that had launched the Doolittle raid and had been at Midway as well. And, you know, we're going to finish her off. They thought about, you know, trying to capture her.
Trying to board her.
Yeah, she was heavily afire at this point. It just wasn't going to happen.
And significantly down by the bow.
So that drawing, I know exactly what you're talking about. When we were doing the Petrel series for Lost Ships of World War II, you were part of it too, John. All three of us were.
Yeah.
We were looking at that picture or the drawing. And if you look at the Japanese drawing, Hornet's straight in the water. If you look at the pictures, the last pictures, the photographs taken by United States Navy ships as they were about to leave the scene, she's got one hell of a list.
Yeah,
so absolutely. I think the Japanese artist took a little artistic license.
Artistic license, yeah.
Absolutely.
She didn't write herself in between those times.
No, they wanted to make it look like they did the,
exactly.
the actual sinking.
Exactly.
Right, so,
exactly.
Yeah. Which they did.
And a side note, one of the reasons that Juno was not in the area when this torpedo attack came, Juno was picking up American aviators that had ditched in the water. Mm-hmm. One of the aviators that Juno picks up, Clay Fisher.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Snags him out of the water. And his gunner, Ferguson. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So tell the story now about Enterprise recovering planes.
This is legendary, man.
It is absolutely legendary.
So, of course, every aircraft carrier has, they actually have two guys that are designated to be what's called landing signal officers, LSOs. And these are qualified aviators themselves.
Yes.
One of Enterprise's LSOs is a guy named Robin Lindsay. Robin Lindsay is generally, also, by the way, side note, David McCampbell, the top fighter ace, U.S. Navy fighter ace of World War II, was also a landing signal officer.
Oh, interesting.
But Robin Lindsay is the LSO on Enterprise right now. And Enterprise has got to land not just her birds. They've Hornets got to land too. Hornets birds, too. And Enterprise has taken three bombs.
Yeah.
So one of her elevators is stuck in the up position, so she can't. And the other elevator is jammed at the same time.
Yeah.
She can't put aircraft in her hangar deck. So Lindsay starts landing every bird he can. It's called the Virtuoso. That's how it's known. It's Robin Lindsay's Virtuoso.
It's incredible.
Performance. It really is.
It's absolutely incredible.
At 12:35, this is after the attack, clearly, Enterprise resumes landing operations and starts to recover, as I said, the remaining aircraft aloft. As Lindsay's landing these people, you know, he's landing them on the third wire. Go ahead.
And for listeners, the LSO is also referred to as paddles.
Right. They're
the people in movies you see that are waving their arms, telling them too high, too low to get the aircraft to hit the number three wire. But go ahead.
And there are five arrestor cables on this aircraft.
Right.
Typically, as a navier, you want to go for the three, which is the middle of that pack. So continue, Seth.
So he's filling the deck up. He receives word from captain of the Enterprise, Osborne Artisan, who says, and he's got headsets on like the, well, a lot older than these. He receives word and he says, you know, basically knock it off, stop landing. You know, you're going to jam up the deck. And God knows what happens if one of these planes crashes. You know, we got a serious problem here.
Or lands and flies into the parked airplanes on the bow. But go ahead.
You're going to have a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. Lindsay is keenly aware that the vast majority of the airplanes aloft are SPDs because he can see them. He also knows that the SPDs are the most valued airplanes aboard American aircraft carriers. What does he do? He takes his headset off and he says, I'm bringing these boys home. And that's precisely what he does. He's landing them on the third wire. Then he starts landing them on the second wire. And then he's dropping
he's
got
to push them.
The
they got to be pushed forward
the
every time you land.
Right?
You got to clear the landing area.
Like, yeah. You know, he's shoving everything absolutely as far forward as he can.
Yep.
There's literally no space left. Mm. Last man aloft is yet again our good friend Swede Vedisa. He's flying his F4F. He's out of ammunition.
And if he
damn low on fuel.
And if he doesn't hit the one wire, I think it was the one wire at this point.
It's the last wire.
He's going to fly into the parked aircraft. So it requires some very precise flying and landing.
And a lot of confidence. And not necessarily in himself, but in the LSO. And he had told me that. He said, I had the ultimate confidence in Robin Lindsay. He says, I was going to follow him no matter what he told me. Mm-hmm. And he could see that the deck is chocked full of aircraft. Swede puts his faith in Lindsay. Lindsay gives him the cut. Swede drops onto one wire. 56 aircraft are parked on Enterprise's flight deck. Damaged flight deck, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, because they can't push them all the way forward either. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just it's absurd.
It remains to this day the pinnacle of landing signal officer operations of probably U.S. Navy history.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm not a naval aviator, and I've never been an LSO. But if they don't still talk about that in LSO school, I would be shocked.
Yeah.
He's the man. Yeah.
Maybe one of our listeners who is a modern-day LSO can tell us.
Yeah, whether or not that's still
he's the legend of all LSOs.
So let's talk about the implications of the battle on the campaign, because now the battle's over. It's over.
Battle's
Enterprise
over.
Is getting the hell out of the way.
Yeah,
Hornets
out of Dodge. Hornets
are dead.
Yeah, Shokaku and Zuiho are running for the exits as well. It's game over at this point.
So, you know, in terms of loss of ships, we, being the United States, lose more ships than the Japanese do. I mean, that's undeniable.
Yep.
a lot of people, myself included, consider this to be a defeat, a tactical defeat.
I agree.
How, strategically, though, it isn't, is it?
Correct. It doesn't change the equation in the waters off Guadalcanal a whit.
Mm-hmm. And that really causes us to abandon the land operation of Guadalcanal.
Right. Exactly. You know, and unless you can solve that sea equation in Iron Bottom Sound, really, I mean, to an extent, this whole battle is being waged over the right to resupply that island, right? That's what it all comes down to. It's logistics. Who gets the right and the privilege to drive their cargo ships into that sound and unload them? And at the end of this battle, the Japanese are no better off than they were before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at a strategic level, I think you have to say that it's a defeat for the Japanese. At least that's my opinion.
Or at least it's not a victory.
And you know, to that end, the Japanese, though, they did view it as a victory, again, because their analysis tended to be, I think, relatively superficial. Well, they thought that they had
sunk the Hornet.
Yeah, well, they thought they had sunk three American carriers. Oh. And so if you count it that way, if they had, in fact, you know, that would have been a tremendous victory for not having lost any ships of their own. But that was not the case. But then that plays into implication number two, which is what ends up happening to the respective air groups that fought this battle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And as we said at the beginning of the episode, this really is the death ride for Japan's carrier aviation corps, at least in terms of the cadre of highly experienced aviators that started this war and attacked at Pearl Harbor. That era is done at this point. The Japanese lose, I believe it's 148 carrier aviators killed in this battle. Wow. That is 38 more than they lost killed at Midway. A lot of people don't know that. But, you know, there's just a tremendous disparity in terms of their aviator losses versus our aviator losses. We were much better at search and rescue and pulling our guys out of the water. So the result is that the quality of Japan's carrier aviators is just gutted at this point. You know, guys like Murata and Seki are irreplaceable.
Right.
They're never going to have them again. And so you see a lot of accounts from the Japanese side where they say that, yeah, we started rebuilding our carrier air groups, you know, in 1943, but the quality of the guys that were coming into the ranks was just nowhere near as good. The other thing I'd say, too, this battle marks what I sort of think of as the beginning of halftime in the carrier war.
This is the last battle of 42.
And it's the last carrier battle that we're going to fight in this war until the Battle of Philippine Sea in June of 1944.
Yeah.
Both sides' carrier forces are just beat to pieces at this point. And what ends up happening then, you know, both sides kind of go back into the locker room. What's going to end up occurring, though, when carrier operations start up again, really sort of at the end of 1943, I guess I sort of look at the carrier raid against Truk in February of 44, Hailstone. That's when the American carrier force really retakes the playing field and are back in the game. By that time, when the Americans come out of that halftime break, they're going to have a completely different and brand new Navy. A lot of Essex class carriers, all flying Grumman Hellcats, you know, which is a much better fighter aircraft. These pilots are going to be much better trained. Our anti-aircraft defenses will be uniformly more formidable. Everybody's going to have Bofors by that time.
Right.
And the VT fuse is going to be in operation as well. So the lethality of American anti-aircraft fire just explodes in that 16-month time frame. And one episode that we didn't talk about, even at the tail end of this battle, when some of those Japanese aviators return to their carriers after their strikes against Enterprise and encounter the firepower that South Dakota was putting up, some of these dudes came out of the cockpit and they were incoherent. They were so shell-shocked by what they had had to fly through to make those attacks. they'd never seen anything even remotely approaching the amount of shellfire that they were taking in the course of those attacks.
And we almost never talk about the Japanese being subjected to the same kind of emotional burden or PTSD that we were subjected to. It's like they were supermen.
Yeah. No, these guys were messed up. And we're only really at the beginning of the transition of American firepower in this war. You know, by the time, again, fast forward to the middle of 1944, the amount of ACAC that our formations could put up dwarfs what it can do in October of 42. And it's already rendering the Japanese speechless. So, yeah, that's kind of what is happening here. That Santa Cruz really does. It's the end of an era in terms of carrier warfare in this war.
So it is. Go ahead, Bill.
No, what I was going to say is, so the curtain comes down on the first phase of carrier operations. Correct. Then for the next few years, it's our naval battle is dominated by the island hopping campaign, where we have aircraft and direct support of landing forces, but it's really about those landings themselves. And we've already established quasi control of the sea. And then the curtain comes back up, the Battle of Philippine Sea.
Right.
Which nickname is the Marianas Turkey Shoot. So,
yep.
All right.
Yeah,
that's where we're going to be.
The key, aside from the Essex class, which are game changers, you know, I mean, these things serve into the friggin' 80s, for Christ's sake. Mm-hmm. But I mean, aside from the entrance of the Essex class carrier to the fray, you know, you mentioned South Dakota. You got to remember, everybody's got to remember, it's not just South Dakota. It's Alabama, Massachusetts, Indiana, North Carolina, Washington, the Iowa class. I mean,
all those fast battleships, yeah.
Yeah, and then all the cruisers that we're building on the ways that are festooned with anti-aircraft weaponry.
Yes.
I mean, it's the American fleet, Task Force 58. Yeah, the Fifth Fleet is
the largest navy in the world all by itself.
It's just nasty. It is nasty.
Well, Seth, we're running long. I think it's time to wrap.
It is. All right. Well, I think we've kind of hit the nail on the head here that you know, this battle does, you know, seal the fate of the Japanese carrier force here, but we take a licking as well. And it's a battle that is very, very important, not just to the seas around Guadalcanal, but to the rest of the war. You know, this more, I think, certainly more than Eastern Solomons, but this far, you know, it's right up there with Midway in my equation of overall effects on the rest of the war. So with that, we want to thank you very much for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast wherever you receive your podcast. Give us a rating and review. We do appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, please subscribe to our YouTube channel called the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War Podcast. Look us up on Facebook, like and subscribe. Send us a question or a comment at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. Once again, my name is Seth Paradin. Thank you very much for listening, Bill.
And John, we're so happy to have you back and can't wait to do another episode with you.
So
see you, everybody.
Here. Thanks.
Oddly enough, we're going to do that in just a minute. So thanks.